Well, we find ourselves Bein Geula LeGeula between Purim and Pesach, and we have a couple of weeks where we can return to discuss the weekly Parsha. And this week we have Parsha Shmini, which actually, according to our yearly schedule, between one thing and another, it's the minority of years that we come to discuss Parsha Shmini, so we should try and do justice to the Parsha. There are many things that come together in Shmini, and begins with the Yom HaShmini itself, Vayi Bayom HaShmini. It's called the eighth day because it follows the 7 days of Miluim, which Rashi tells us those 7 days were the last 7 days of Adar, which puts the Yom HaShmini on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And this is the day of the inauguration of the Mishkan. The 7 days of Miluim were preparatory days, so to speak. But this is the first day of the full functioning of the Mishkan. And in recognition and expression of this, there are special korbanos that were just for the Yom HaShmini. Many korbanos began that would continue as part of the regular operation of the Mishkan. But there are special korbanos for this opening day. And let us take a look at a couple of them. In Pasuk Gimel, Perek Tes Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk Beis describes Aaron's korbanos, which he had to bring on that day, and then Pasuk Gimel are the Jewish people's korban. Ve'el b'nei Yisrael tedaber lemor. And to b'nei Yisrael, should say as follows, K'chu si'ir izim l'chatos. Take a seir izim, a goat, for a chatas, a sin offering, the eagle, and a calf, the keves, b'nei shana, and also a lamb within their first year, temimim le'ola. And we have before us three korbanos and the teras kohanim. On this pasuk, focuses on two of them, namely the seir izim, the goat for the chatas, and the calf for an Ola. What is the significance of that choice of Korban? We tend to perhaps look at all Korbanos as largely the same, and then we miss out, because each one has its character, each one has its contribution. And the Toras Kohanim says as follows, Amar Lahem, Moshe says to the Jewish people, Atem yesh b'yedchem b'tchila, you, the Jewish people, you have something, a problem in the beginning, an issue from the beginning, v'yesh b'yedchem basof, and you have an issue at the end. What's the beginning? What's the end? The Medrash specifies, yesh b'yedchem batchila. You have an issue from the beginning, and it quotes, v'yishchatu si'ir izim. They slaughtered a goat. That quotation is from Parshas Vayeshev. That is about the brothers having sold Yosef. They then slaughtered the goat. They dipped the kasonis in the blood. And therefore, this first issue relates to the sale of Yosef, seemingly. That's number one. That's outstanding business. V'yesh b'yedchem basov. And then you also have something at the end, of course, looming very large in recent history, Asulahem Egel Masecha, the Egel, the golden calf. Therefore, Yavosi Irizim, let the goat come, V'yichaper al Maaseh Izim, and atone for what happened with the goat, Mechiras Yosef, Yavo Egel, V'yichaper al Maaseh Egel. Let the Egel come, and V'mechaper for the golden calf. And as we can appreciate, there are a couple of questions that we can and should raise regarding this medrash. Firstly, what's Mechiras Yosef got to do with anything that we're dealing with here? We can understand that the Yom HaShmini, the Mishkan, which comes as testimony that we've been forgiven for the Egel, so there's yet room to complete, to the extent that we can, the expiation and atonement of the Chet HaEgel. I mean, that's the matter at hand. but we seem to be dredging up prehistory. All those years ago, there was this other thing that happened, Mechiras Yosef, maybe we should take care of that also. It sounds like this is the first chance that we've had to deal with any of these things, and therefore we backlog to whatever was there, however long ago it was. But what is the essential connection between Mechiras Yosef and what is trying to be achieved on this opening day of the Mishkan? Ma inyan Mechiras Yosef etzel Yom Hashmini. Secondly, the terminology or phraseology of the Medrash is also interesting, because it refers to these two events or episodes as Tchila and Sof, beginning and end. But in what way are they the beginning and the end? The beginning of what? The end of what? Are they connected to each other? It's true that one came before the other, but that's not called beginning and end. That's called earlier and later. That's called first and second. But how are they? How is it beginning and end? And there are many perushim which have been offered for this comment of the Taras Kohanim. The Malbim says something very interesting. Indeed, there is something that brings together Mechiras Yosef and the Egel for full kapara. Both need to be addressed. It's interesting to ponder that between these two events, the sale of Yosef and the making of the Egel, they are almost opposite in nature. How so? With regards to Mechiras Yosef, as we know, every action contains the intent behind the action, and then the action itself, the result. What does it affect? What was it intended to do, and what did it end up doing? Well, what was Mechiras Yosef intended to do? The brothers, their intention was to get rid of Yosef, and that was considered to be incorrect, and to cause him all manner of harm, and get him out the way. So the intention was negative, was harmful. The result was actually very positive. Against everything that they tried to do, and in spite of all they tried to do, they ended up propelling Yosef to greatness. And he ended up saving them and the region. The outcome was actually positive. And that is something, of course, that Yosef himself says to the brothers. Not only is he trying to comfort them and to console them, but he's expressing the reality. Atem chashavtem alai l'ra'a. You intended something bad to happen. Harikim chashav l'tova. Kodesh Baruch Hu arranged it in a way that it came out very good, very positive. And therefore, if we would identify the area of wrongdoing with regards to Mechiras Yosef, it would be in the area of intent and not in the area of outcome. The Egel is actually the opposite. Ramban, in his lengthy discussion of the Egel, one can see it from the Psukim, as much as clearly something wasn't right from the beginning, but it certainly did not start out the way that it ended. Day one of the Egel was not unkosher, in the sense that they had their reasons, and Moshe's gone, and we need some way of receiving guidance from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You could ask, why make an Egel? Why not choose Aaron? There are questions. But the intention behind making the Egel was itself not categorically objectionable. It's something that deteriorated between day one and day two. Then it became something of Avodah Zarah, if not close to that. Which means, and that's why it's actually referred to as a shogeg, as an unintentional, Moshe Rabbeinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, reveals to him all the 13 midos Sherachamim. Nose Oven Mafesha V'chata'a, as opposed to with the episode of the Meraglim, which was much more willful, there is no reference to Chet, which has a connotation of lack of willful intent. And therefore, the Chet HaEgel was actually the opposite in this respect to Mechiras Yosef, because the intention was not so objectionable, but the outcome, of course, was a complete disaster. Therefore, when Bnei Yisrael come to seek full kapara for the Egel, perhaps they may say that in consideration of the fact that we didn't mean it badly, But even though it turned out bad, perhaps the focus should be on our intention and thus to exonerate us. And that, therefore, is the move of the Jewish people. Focus on the intent and not the outcome. The problem is, if you do that, you will then bring back something that has been latent for a while, namely Mechiras Yosef. Because if you wish to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should judge people only by their intent, then something that hasn't really been addressed yet, namely Mechiras Yosef, where the intent was specifically the wrongful area, that will then need further kapara. And that is why Mechiras Yosef, the sale of Yosef, and the making of the Egel, they come together, because in a sense you can't have it both ways. If you wish to shift the emphasis to intent, so then you will then need to answer to Mechiras Yosef, where the intent was very wrong. And that, says the Malbim, is the meaning behind the expression Yesh b'yedchem batchila, v'yesh b'yedchem basof. There's an issue in the beginning and the end. We took the terms beginning and end historically, as if to say the earlier and the later. But the Malbim says beginning and end doesn't relate to the chronological sequence, was one before and one came after, but namely what happens at the beginning of the act and what happened at the end of the act. You have a problem, batchila, namely what you intended going in, because in Mechiras Yosef, the problem was in the beginning. How did they intend for the sale? What did they wish for it to affect? The Egel is called basof, not because it happened later, but because the problem is in the sof. The problem is in what came out of it. And therefore, since between these two, you have an issue, betchila, the intention going in, and basof, the outcome, as it happened, you'll need to be mechaper for both of them because you can't then keep on moving between the two. Ultimately, both will need to be addressed. So this is a very interesting explanation of the Malbim, how these two episodes come together. It brings up an association of the other. I would add, and I don't think the Malbim would object, it's mutter to raise questions. You see, it's very interesting that according to the Malbim, the Seir, the goat, is specifically coming to address the intention of the brothers, whereas the Egel is coming to address the outcome of the Chet HaEgel. That's in synopsis, that's what the Malbim is saying. So what is very interesting in light of this? What type of korban is the goat? And what type of korban is the Egel? The Pasuk says, Kehusi irizim lechatas. The goat is a chatas, is a sin offering. The Egel is an olav. Why is that of significance for us? Because, generally speaking, a korban chatas more affects atonement for a wrongful deed, not so much a wrongful intent. And that's why a chatas tends to be for a shogeg, an unintentional sin. A person does something, whatever, if it's sufficiently severe, but unintentionally, that to me brings a chatas, because a chatas relates to the deed as it came out. In contrast to this, an ola, as the Gemara says in Maseches Vachim, ola is mechaper al hirurei halev. It's more for the person's thoughts in terms of what he intended to do. And therefore it's rather interesting, and perhaps a point that needs further resolution, if according to the Malbim, the goat is specifically about the intention of Mechiras Yosef, so why is it a chatas, which normally relates to deeds? And by the same token, the Egel, which is about the outcome, the practical outcome of the Chet HaEgel, so why is that an Ola, which normally addresses the area of thought? That's a question for scholars to discuss and perhaps resolve. But in any case, these are the comments of Malbim with that reference to that Teras Kohen. As we know, the Yom HaShmini, this opening day, was marred by tragedy. Along with the recovery from the Chet HaEgel, there was another episode. Chumash VaYikra doesn't so much have the historical episodes of Yetzias Mitzrayim and coming to Eretz Yisrael, but it has these short episodes of just things that happened within the context of Chumash VaYikra. And we refer, of course, to the deaths of Nadab and Avihu, of Aaron's two sons, which are described in the beginning of Perek Yud. And let's see how the Pasuk describes it. It happens very swiftly. Pasuk Aleph, Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph, Ayichu b'nei Aaron, Nadav Aviu, Ishmach Toso, Aaron's sons, Nadav and Aviu, each one took their fire pan, Vayitnu v'hen Eish, they placed fire on it, Vayosim alech Keteres, they put incense, Vayakrivu l'fnei Hashem, Eish Zora, Asher lo tziva Hashem, and they offered a foreign fire, that is to say, their own fire, that which Hashem had not commanded. That's it. Whatever happened is referred to in Pasuk Aleph. What about retribution? Pasuk Beis, Vateitze Eish Milefnei Hashem, Vatochal Osam. Fire came out from before Hashem and consumed them. Vayamusu Lefnei Hashem. They died before Hashem. Pasuk Aleph, wrongdoing. Pasuk Beis, punishment. It's done. Pasuk Gimel, reflection. Vayomer Moshe El Aaron. What does Moshe say to Aaron? An amazing thing. Hu Asher Dibur Hashem Neimor Bikrovai Ekadesh. Thus, this is what Hashem was saying when he said that he will be sanctified through those that are close to him. Pnei Kol Amakaved and will be honored by the people. Vayidom Aharon, and Aaron is silent. What is the meaning of this episode? The Meshech Chachma himself makes the following observation. There's many, many explanations in Chazal as to what exactly Nadav and Aviu did wrong, either earlier or on the day, at the time, and perhaps they combine. But it's quite clear that if one looks at the Pasuk does not seem to in any way present what they did as something overly severe. The way the Pasuk describes it is that they offered a fire that Hashem had not commanded. It doesn't say that they did something that Hashem had forbidden. Obviously, when one follows the logic through, if Hashem didn't command it, it's not appropriate. But it really seems to be presented in a rather mild way in the Pasuk, in a rather slight way. And yet, they were punished. And how does this relate to everything else that's going on the Yom HaShmini? And Meshech Chochmah makes a very profound statement here. Indeed, the death of Nadav and Aviv, and you look at Moshe, we're not sure what to make of Nadav and Aviv anymore. Because if you look at the first pasuk, it sounds like they did something wrong. If you look at the second pasuk, they're punished, it sounds like they did something very wrong. And if you look at the third pasuk, it sounds like they were these amazing tzaddikim. And Moshe says, you see, Hashem said he would be sanctified by those that are close to him. So it's a very blended and complicated picture that we get. And how does it relate to the opening of the Mishkan? Well, what is the opening of the Mishkan about? It is about a celebration, or at least marking the fact that Jewish people had achieved fundamental atonement and rehabilitation for the Chet HaEgel. It's a day which marks the Kapara for the Eagles. The first time the Jewish people as a nation had done something terribly wrong and had then recovered and received atonement. Says Meshech Chochmah, this first experience of receiving Kapara was a very, shall we say, joyous time, but it's a very sensitive time. It can potentially be misunderstood, it can potentially be abused, and the whole concept of kapara can be completely misused. How so? Because kapara says that as much as the Jewish people did something terribly wrong and they were in terrible danger, and but through their tshuva, Hashem has atoned for them, and they're okay again. So now the question is, what are they to make of Kapara? It's the first Kapara nationally. What are they to make of it? How are they to absorb it? And moreover, what does it say about sin? Because the abuse of the concept of Kapara is, if a person says, well, I did a sin, but then I did Shuvah and Hashem forgave me, so the reality is they were in danger and Shuvah got them out of danger. But it's possible to take advantage of the concept of tshuva as if to say, oh, I guess it wasn't really that serious in the first place, because look, everything's okay. And that really is the wrong way to look at things. And once again, when a person goes through a process that everything turns out okay, it either meant that it wasn't okay and became okay again, or maybe it was always okay in the first place. That is confusing. and replacing the concept of kapara for vatronus. Vatronus means it doesn't really make a difference if you do something wrong. Look, we did something wrong and here we are, everything's okay. And therefore, alongside and for purposes of giving the Jewish people an authentic and meaningful way of relating to their kapara, it was important that on that occasion, an avera did not go unpunished. That is to say, it was in order to vouchsafe the concept of kapara for all generations that you had something that maybe even something relatively mild, and it was met with swift retribution. That lets the Jewish people understand in no uncertain terms that if they violate Hashem's will, they are in trouble. They are in danger. Tshuva can help, but the danger is there. And the only way you can see that the danger is there is by some people who are almost like a korban now. Their lives are given in order to express this point absolutely clearly that sin does bring about danger. And thus, we find that Nadav and Avihu, again, the way the Pasuk describes it in its words, do not seem to have done something terribly wrong. It's relatively mild. Number two, when is all this happening? On the first day of the Mishkan, which is referred to by Chazal as Yom Simchas Libo, the day of Hashem's joy, based on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Yom Chasunoso, Yom Simchas Libo. Very often when a person is in his day of joy, so he will be much more forgiving, much more foregoing. Because as something that on a normal day he may have taken the person to task for, but it's Yom Simchas Libo, he lets it go. I mean, Lahavdil, but just from our experience, you know, on Purim, lots of things happen on Purim that if they happened on any other day, the full weight of the law would be brought down on the person. But it's Purim, okay, something broke, let it go. He spoke out of turn, whatever it might be. So it's Yom Simchas Libo, which tends to bring with it a magnanimous frame of mind. And moreover, these are two of the people that have credit, so to speak, Bakodesh Baruch Hu. They're from Shevet Levi, they're not the Kohanim, they're the epicenter of the people that are okay. In the end, none of it made a difference. And they were punished. And how do the Jewish people relate to this? Jewish people now realize, wow, we really were in trouble. Look at them. They were trouble, they didn't get out of it. We were in trouble, we got out of it. But there was trouble. That's what kapara means. As if to say, sin is toxic, and tshuva is the antidote. But the moral of the story is not that there was never an issue in the first place. And that, says Meshech Chochma, brings us to Pasuk Gimel. What does Moshe say to Aaron? Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, Hu asher dibur Hashem Lemor, Bikrovaya Kadesh, I will be sanctified through those that are close to me, Ba'apnei Kol HaAmek Aved, and I will be honored by the nation. How are these two outcomes related to each other? Says Meshech Chochma, they're a continuum. They're causationally related. It is specifically through HaKadosh Baruch Hu being sanctified by those close to him, i.e. Nadav and Avihu, that he then becomes honored by the people. Because if this hadn't happened to Nadav and Avihu, the worry is that tshuva will not bring to honor, that people on the contrary will take Torah, which is based on doing the right thing, they'll take the whole thing lightly, it will lead to zilzul. Ukidai b'zayon v'katzeh. Because they see, an avera is not a big deal. Nadav and Avihu taught them it's a big deal, Bikrovaya Kadesh, and therefore it brought honor to Hashem when he gave them kapara. And that's why the Pasuk says, Vayidom Aaron. It's very difficult to know what to make of Aaron's silence. The Pasuk just says that he was quiet. And we might normally understand the Pasuk is saying he didn't he didn't say anything, he accepted it, perhaps with stoically or... He accepted it, but the point is, it's more than that. Not only did he accept this tragic event, but he accepted what Moshe said to him, and that's why he appreciated the meaning of the deaths of Nadav and Avihu. And moreover, says Meshech Chochma, there were implications for the Jewish people. Let's have a look at Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron. He tells them to continue their avoda as was. And your brothers, the house of Israel, they should mourn and cry for the conflagration that Hashem ignited, that Hashem burnt. As if to say that everyone should mourn for Nadav and Aviv. And Meshech Chochma asked a simple question. Why? Why should everyone mourn for Nadav and Aviv? As if to say, no one should be happy for them. And it's a terrible thing. But if they did something wrong, and they were punished, so, okay, it's unfortunate, but that's the law. Mourning represents almost like a tragedy, but how does it affect each and every Jew? But the point is, says Meshech Chochma, according to our discussion, Nadav and Aviv died, so to speak, for the sake of the Jewish people. That is to say, in order the Jewish people should know how to relate to their kapara correctly. And therefore the fact that they had to die is, from a certain point of view, represents a shortcoming on the part of the Jewish people. If there was no worry that they might abuse the concept of kapara, then Nadav and Aviv would never have had to die. But there was that worry. And therefore it really is a tragedy in which all Jewish people have a part. And that's why Acheichem Kobeis Yisrael Yivku Es HaStreifa. So this is a very profound, I believe, approach to this very rather enigmatic section of the death of Nadav and Aviv. And I believe perhaps one may add, we're in terms of the calendar, we're yet far away, but it is interesting that the Avoda of Yom Kippur also starts with a reference to the death of Nadav and Aviv. And moreover, in our own experience, that's part of the beginning of Parshas Acharimos, and in our own experience, the laning, the Kriyas HaTorah for Yom Kippur morning starts with Acharimos. Now, you know that on each Yom Tov, in a sense, we cut to the chase. We extract, or we begin the section of the Parsha that has bearing on the theme of the day. The theme of the day of Yom Kippur is Avodas Yom Kippur. So for whatever Parsha reasons, it may mention Nadav and Aviv, but why for Yom Kippur reasons do we bring it in? The first words you hear from the Baal Koreh on Yom Kippur are the deaths of Nadav and Aviv. What's it got to do with me? I've got my own problems. And moreover, the Zohar says that it speaks and extols the idea of mourning for the deaths of Nadav and Aviv on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, when you hear the laning, the Zohar says a person should cry at the mention of the death of Nadav and Aviv, which means not only were the Jewish people at the time meant to mourn for Nadav and Aviv, but the Jewish people for all time are meant to mourn for Nadav and Aviv. But why? But I believe a very meaningful answer to this question is based on the words of Meshech Chochma, as if to say, every Jew on Yom Kippur faces the very same challenge that the Jewish people had at that time. When they received their kapara, there was a danger that they may have misinterpreted it, that they may have taken advantage of it, and to say, oh, I can get kapara and everything will be okay, which means everything that I do in the interim doesn't matter, because you see in the end you get kapara. And it could lead to a lessening of one's regard for the severity of a wrongdoing and the importance of doing the right thing. And therefore, in a sense, we begin the laning on Yom Kippur by remembering Nadav and Aviv. And we should take that moment to recognize them, because we don't want to repeat the mistake that they died in order that Jewish people should not make that mistake. It's a reminder that as powerful that the tshuva is, it is only more powerful than sin, which is equally powerful. It happens to be that tshuva overpowers it. But without tshuva, one should never think that the sins themselves are less than the serious events that they are. So these are some thoughts with regards to Nadav and Aviv. Later on in the parsha, as we move on, so we come to the section of kashrus, of ma'acholas asurim, as they're called, and that takes up perik yud aleph, and rishonim ponder the meaning of these species than one may not eat, in the realms of Tameh HaMitzvahs. What's it all about? And this question has been discussed by many Rishonim, and they are divided into perhaps more than two, but certainly at least two approaches. The Rambam, in the Mara Nevuchim, when he discusses the things that the Torah forbids the Jewish people to eat, so he says that these are things that are physically harmful and unhealthy to eat, and therefore the Torah warns against them. This is the explanation of the Rambam in the Mara Nevuchim, and it has the concurrence of the Sefer HaChinuch. However, many Rishonim take exception to this approach and to this explanation. The Akedas Yitzchak, who discusses this at length, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, so he comes at the end of the Rishonim, and in a sense he partakes of the whole discussion which has come before him. The Akedas Yitzchak asks a simple question. Imagine that one could somehow sanitize these animals. Imagine that one could somehow treat them in a way that they could be empirically shown to be not harmful anymore. Shall we say that there's no reason not to eat them anymore? That's, he considers, to be inconceivable. But clearly the Torah has categorically forbidden them, regardless of whether or not one could somehow render them not unhealthy. Secondly, as the Akedas Yitzchak, all the nations of the world which are not bound by the laws of the Torah, so they partake of these species, do we see that it damages their health? Do we see that it impacts it? Do we see that it harms them? One could say that perhaps the constitution of the Jewish people is different and these are harmful for the Jewish people, perhaps. But the Akedas Yitzchak assumes that on the basic physiological level, everyone is the same, and therefore one can see, one literally has the millions and by now billions of examples of people. If there's something unhealthy, but we don't know that it's necessarily these things that they eat. And surely that should be evidence that it is not about a physical health issue. Thirdly, asked the Akedah, but what are we saying? We're saying the Torah here is essentially giving the Jewish people guidance in terms of what's healthy and what's unhealthy. Asked the Akedah, so why did it limit this discussion to the animal kingdom? As if to say there's many vegetables and fruits, etc., and some of them are healthy and some of them are unhealthy and some of them are poisonous. So one doesn't want to reach a stage where a person, he abides by all the laws of the Torah, he avoided every single animal the Torah said not to eat, and then he ate a vegetable and it killed him because the Torah never told him that you can't eat that either. But if it's about protecting the physical health, so anything that could potentially damage one's health should have been within the parsha. And finally, and this is, it's a matter of approach, really, but the Akedas Yitzchak considers it to be undesirable that at the end of the day, the Torah, which is meant to be a guide for elevated living on the highest spiritual level, has a section which is just things that are healthy, things that are unhealthy. I mean, he sees that as a lessening of the madriga, really, of the type of thing that the Torah talks about. There is a mitzvah, v'nishmartem le'od nafshaseichem, there's a mitzvah to protect your health, but the Torah leaves it up to the person to find out. It doesn't devote valuable space to this species is healthy, this species is not, is unhealthy. That's beneath what the sphere that the Torah discusses. So between all of them, these four questions, each one in their own way, are quite serious charges against the approach which was presented by the Rambam. And for that reason, the other school of Rishonim, Ramban, the Akedas Yitzchak himself, and the Abarbanel. Akedas Yitzchak and Abarbanel were very close in time. They both thrown out of Spain. Same time. Explain that ultimately it is not it's not about physical well-being, it's not about the harmful effects on a physiological level, but rather there is something about these species which is spiritually damaging. And moreover, perhaps one may say that, and raise a basic question, what is the parsha of kosher and non-kosher food, what's it doing in Chumash Vayikra? As if to say, we know that Chumash Vayikra is called Toras Kohanim. It is devoted to mitzvahs that surround the Beis HaMikdash and Korbanos, etc. and in the middle of everything, it's like the Torah takes a break and says you can eat this, you can't eat this, but what's it got to do with the Mishkan, or what's it got to do with the Kohanim, what's got things that are not kosher for non-Kohanim also. So how does it find its way into Chumash Vayikra? Perhaps in a sense there's a parallel here, as if to say the world of Korbanos is essentially using the animal kingdom vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu, vis-a-vis the Beis HaMikdash, in the most positive way, and therefore, apropos of that, we're also told which of the animal kingdom are harmful for us. That's the full description, therefore, of essentially of how to relate to the animal kingdom in spiritual terms. What to use for korbanos, what not to use for korbanos, and what to use for consumption, for a person's own eating, and what needs to be avoided. So that now is very apropos within Chumash Vayikra, which is the Chumash of Kedusha. And moreover, it should be noted that as much as we say that the Torah never spoke about kashrus before Vayikra, that's not entirely true. Certainly, we've never had a presentation like this before Vayikra. Parsha Shmini, it's a whole chapter. But there was one posuk in Chumash Shemos. We've already read it in Parshas Mishpatim, which deals with something that is non-kosher. That's treifa. Treifa, an animal however you define treifa, those conditions. But and the Torah says you can't eat it. Ubasa basada treifa lo tochelu. That's in Parshas Mishpatim. And what is of great significance there? The Torah introduces that prohibition against eating treifa by saying va'anshe kodesh tiyuli. Ubasa basada treifa lo tochelu. You see the treifas, which already is a taste, so to speak, of the world of macholas asuras and non-kosher entities, is introduced with ba'anshei kodesh tiyuli. That tells us that it is about ultimately kedusha and not about physical well-being. With all due respect to physical well-being, but the halachas of kashrus are not about that. Interestingly, if we ponder further. So if it's about spiritual harm, what form can that take? So clearly the full answer is beyond us. It's in the cosmic realm of how the HaKadosh Baruch Hu has wired the universe in spiritual terms. But you will find, says Ramban, that the animals that the Torah forbids tend to be animals of prey and birds of prey. And that is that's a characteristic. And the Ramban is, if he's not saying you are what you eat, in the sense that you could actually absorb those characteristics if you partake of animals that have those characteristics, but certainly that association, which is on a moral level, that's really part of what the Torah is looking to distance us from and protect us from, not just quote unquote the issue of physical well-being. An interesting shaila with regards to the kosher species. As we know, it's got to have split hooves, it's got to chew the cud. So if it has split hooves, it's kosher. But if the hooves are closed, not kosher. That's one of the signs. So the question is asked, these what we call simanim, these kosher signs, are they signs or are they more than signs? And what do we mean by that? You see, what we're saying is, if it has split hooves, it's kosher. If it has the closed hooves, it's not kosher. Is that a way of identifying a kosher animal? Or would we rather say that perhaps it is that characteristic that makes it kosher? The split hoof makes it kosher. A closed hoof makes it not kosher. Those are causational. They're not just evidence of a kosher or non-kosher animal. But they're actually there what make it kosher or not kosher. In the parlance of the yeshiva world, really what we're asking is, these characteristics, are they siba or siman? Are they causes or are they symptoms? That is the question. And should we ask, which we are entitled to, what difference does it make? Having introduced the Londisha parlance, so we would ask, what's a nafka mina? What difference does it make at the end of the day? Kosher, kosher, not kosher, not kosher. Says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, it seems that this question could have halachic ramifications and is actually the subject of a debate amongst the Tanoim, between Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim. How so? The Gemara in Maseches Chulin, on Daf Ayin Omid Aleph, which must be round about where the Daf Yomi is, they may have passed it recently. what happens if there's an animal with split hooves, but it gives birth to an animal whose hooves are sealed? I wouldn't say there's one in every family, but it can happen. So the question is that that child, right, that baby animal, is it kosher or not kosher? Says Reb Shimon, it's not kosher. It's got sealed hooves. It's not kosher. But the Chachamim say it is kosher. And what are we to make of this machlokas? Yes, kosher, not kosher. Says Reb Chanan Wasserman, it seems that really their argument is revolves around this question. Does this characteristic, does it tell you that it is a kosher animal? Or this is what makes it kosher? You see, if it tells you, if it's a siman, if it tells you that it's a kosher animal, I know it's a kosher animal. I knew its mother. meaning that the mother is for sure a kosher animal. I know where it came from. There's no question. It didn't come from the wild. And I assume it came from a non-kosher animal. I know for a fact it came from a kosher animal. That's all I need. And therefore, even though its hooves are sealed, but I don't need evidence because the evidence comes from the mother. That's why the Chachamim say that it's kosher, because it's a siman, and here I don't need the siman. Whereas according to Rabbi Shimon, it's a siba. It's the cause. And therefore, this actually, the mother has split hooves, and that's what makes the mother kosher. But this has sealed hooves, and that's what makes it non-kosher. And that's the conceptual underpinnings of that machlokas there. Very interesting. That type of discussion within even the practical laws of kashrus. As we know, as soon as there are two signs that you need in order for it to be kosher, so the question comes up, what if the animal has one of those signs? Again, it's chewing the cud and split hooves. What if it has one? It chews the cud but doesn't have split hooves, or vice versa. The Torah itself discusses this question in the Psukim of Perek Yud Aleph. It gives us Pasuk Dalet, because there are actually four animals or species that have this condition. Firstly, the camel. Malageiruhu. It chews the cud, but it doesn't have split hooves. It does the way that its feet are, it's not in the configuration of split hooves, that's for sure. But it does chew the cud, but it's not kosher. And then you have the shafan in Pasuk Hey, and then you have the arnevis in Pasuk Vav, as they are referred to, the hyrax and the hare. They also chew the cud in whatever form they do, but they do not have split hooves. And then you have the chazir, the pig, which is the opposite. Mafris parasuhu, it does have split hooves, but it does not chew the cud. There is a very well-known statement of the Medrash regarding these four species, and that is that they correspond to the four exiles of the Jewish people. It goes through them one by one and associates them each with one of the exiles. The first three are the first three exiles. They are Bavel and Paras, which we just had in Purim, and then Yavon, those are those three. And then the fourth, the pig, is Rome. The pig is Edom, that the Gaulus that we are still currently in Rome, and its associates and affiliates. Interestingly, Rabbeinu Bachya draws our attention to the fact that this will explain how these four types of animals are also presented later on in the Torah slightly differently. How so? As we know, the whole parsha of kosher species, non-kosher species, we see it for the first time in our parsha, Shmini, but we'll see it again in Sefer Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh. And in Re'eh, it will yet again go through all of the four species, that they have one siman, another other siman. What is the difference between them? The difference between them is that if you look in our parsha, which we did and we read, you see that these four species are described or discussed over the course of four psukim. That is to say, each species has its own pasuk. If you look later on in Parshas Re'eh, all species are condensed into two psukim. The first three are all in one pasuk. The camel and the hyrax and the hare, they're all in one pasuk. And then the pig is in the second pasuk. How come it was condensed? Well, balabatishly, one could say it is Chumash Devarim. It speaks things in a somewhat more synopsized form, and it is also true that the first three have the same siman in common. They all three chew the cud but don't have split hooves. But Rabbeinu Bachya says this duality within the presentation of of the four galios, it allows us to evaluate the fourth galus relative to the first three. As if to say, although formally there are four, and each one is its own galus, quite so, but from a certain point of view, the fourth galus, it's practically an illegal of its own, in the sense that it has been longer than all of the other three put together. And interestingly, he also draws our attention to the fact that when Daniel, he has his vision of the four beasts, which also correspond to the four galios, but the Medrash tells us that he had that vision actually over two nights. And the first night he saw the first three beasts, and the second night he saw number four. Now that's not an equal division. I mean, if you take four, divide it into two, so it should be two per night. But no, because that's already Daniel again experiencing the notion that number four, it single-handedly, it's equal to the other three as a galus. And therefore, in our parsha, each one has its own pasuk, because in real time, each one was its own galus. But in Mishneh Torah, which has a certain retrospective aspect to it, you really see how they're grouped together. The first three, they're all one relative to number four, which is which is in the second pasuk, keneged kulam, so to speak. And that number four, which is the chazir, which is the pig, corresponds to Rome. And as far in terms of Jewish thought, we are essentially still in that galus. There is a fascinating comment of the Medrash here. Two comments, in fact, Vayikra Rabbah, commenting on the word chazir, because the Medrash associates the word chazir, which of course means pig, but chazir is also related to the concept of la chazir, to return. And what does that mean? Says the Medrash, the reason why it's called a chazir is Mipnei she'osid lachazir atara liyoshna, that in the end it will return the crown to its former glory. What does this mean? Says Rabbeinu Bachya, what it means is, and in fact, before we get to the meaning, it's interesting just to note parenthetically, but I think quite pertinent. This drasha, this statement of the Medrash, it's called the Chazir, Mipnei She'asid LaChazir Atara LeYoshna, it's a Chiddush. Why is it a Chiddush? I mean, aside from everything that it's saying, even before we ponder its meaning, and everything in the Medrash is a Chiddush, but it's a linguistic Chiddush. And the reason I say that is because the word Chazir, in its sense of returning, to best of my knowledge, but I have checked through, does not appear anywhere in Tanakh. Meaning it's not a biblical word, chozer. The Torah only ever uses the word lashuv, to return, or lahashiv, to give something back. Shavuz Aveda, tshuva, etc. Throughout all of Tanakh, I do not believe that, in fact, it is the case that the word chozer is not used. It's a chazal word. It's a later word. So it's very interesting, therefore, that not only are chazal associating the word chazir with lachazir, which is already a chiddush, but it's a further chiddush because the Torah itself does not use the word chazir. Of course, one doesn't know what's the cause and what's the effect. Maybe that itself is what led Chazal to begin to use the word chazir. The same thing is true, by the way, while we're talking about this, with regards to the word mechila. The concept of mechila, well, that is to say, the concept exists. The term mechila does not appear anywhere in Tanakh as forgiveness or pardon. You will find slicha and you will find kapara, but not mechila. Also very interesting, of the three terms that we say, slachlanu, mechalanu, kapralanu, two of those are from Tanakh and one of them are from Chazal. But the concept of mechila is also darshaned from the Torah in a very interesting way. It's the idea that when one gets married, they get mechila, is actually from Parshas Vayishlach, because one of Esav's wives was called machlas. And although when we hear machlas, we think it sounds like a disease, but it is actually darshan as an expression of mechila. But once again, it's very interesting, not only to darshan the name from machlas to mechila, but the idea that the word mechila itself is not a Tanakh word. In any case, that's for the Baalei Haloshon to ponder further. But nachzor l'inyaneinu. So we say that the chazir she'asid lachzir atar liyoshna, they'll return the crown to its former glory. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, what does it mean? It means the forces of Rome in the fullness of time will themselves give Israel back to the Jewish people. And that's very interesting. We're still in the middle of that process. But from a significant point of view, depending on how you look at it, without getting into this as its own discussion, when essentially the Western world grouped together all those years ago and voted to return at least some of Israel to the Jewish people, I think it's fair to say it's possible to see within that the fulfillment of She'asid Lachzir Yisrael. They never agreed on anything since. Further, says the Medrash, on the word Chazir, Asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lachzira LiYisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will in the future return it to the Jewish people. Now, what does that mean? If it's a separate idea, what does that mean? Says Rabbeinu Bachya, the masses believe, the masses believe that what this medrash means to say is that in the future, the pigs will be kosher. She'asid lachazira liYisrael. In the end, Hashem will return it to the Jewish people. Interestingly, when you talk about returning it, that means it was taken away. I guess it was taken away in our parsha when the Torah says you can't eat it, and then it will be given back. As if to say, it refers to the actual animal chazir. Rabbeinu Bachya is adamant that the Medrash does not mean that. When it says she'asid lachazir alanu, it's another way of saying that in the end, once again, it will return to us. It's another way of expressing that Israel will be given back to us by those forces. It is a much more cosmic idea, and it's not a question of the animal, the chazir itself. Subsequent mefarshim grappled with this idea. The pasuk says, "Asid lachazir alanu," in the future, pigs will be kosher. What does that mean? This question was addressed to the Radvaz, Rabbeinu David Ibn Zamra, in his Shuvas, in Chelek Beis, volume 2, number 828. Ukvar nishalti, I've already been asked, al kayot sebaze, on this sort of thing, she'amru Chazal said, lam nekras shemo chazir. Why is it called the chazir? She'asa lekadosh baruch hu lachzira liYisrael, that Hashem will return it to Yisrael. Unafiyat pshat. What does this mean? On a straightforward level, it's a very interesting thing when you get a medrash and you explain the pshat in the medrash. But unafiyat pshat, the most straightforward meaning of what the medrash means to say, efshe letaretz ader chashikasavti. What it means is ki yihyu Yisrael ochlim mashmanim. In other words, in the future, it is a way of expressing. It's like an expression of the bounty and the plenty that will exist in the world. The Jewish people, so they'll want for nothing, right? Everyone will have whatever they need. It's a way of expressing just how much there will be, as if to say the pigs are mutter for them. It's not a halachic statement that it's mutter to eat a pig, but the point is they won't want for anything. It's like you'll get the feeling that they have everything they could possibly want. V'lo shiyutar lahem basar chazir chas v'shalom. So that's the Radvaz's approach to this medrash, that in the end the pig will be returned, as if to say to the Jewish people they'll be mahadrin everything. So then you won't even it's lahavdo, and I don't miss this to be taken the wrong way, but it's like Pesach nowadays. One feels that there's nothing that one can't eat. Of course, the fact remains it is with the most stringent of terms that the Torah says you can't eat chametz, but everything is kosher to Pesach practically, except for chametz, and one almost feels that there's nothing missing. And in fact, the Radvaz says that is how he also explains the well-known statement in the Medrash, that all the Moadim in the future, all the festivals will be discontinued. Asidat Amodim libatel. That's not a halachic statement, says Radvaz. What it means is every day will be so wonderful that one will almost feel like every day is a Yom Tov. So it'll be hard to tell the difference when an actual Yom Tov comes. Nowadays, you can tell. But in the future, the difference will be so marginalized, it's almost like there's no Yom Tovim anymore, because every day is amazing. He says it in the same tshuva. That's the approach of the Radvaz. However, after everything that we've quoted, there is a school of thought amongst Meforshim, and in fact it seems to be corroborated also by at least one opinion in the Medrash Tehillim, that indeed the chazir itself will become mutter. I'm not sure if the Jewish people will be interested in eating it by that stage. That's a separate question. That's a matter of taste. But this question is discussed by one of the great Mekubalim of the early Acharonim, the Rama Mipano, Rabbeinu Menachem Mezarim Mipano, is a well-known sefer, Asara Ma'amoros. And he raises the question, how can this be? It is a direct contradiction to the idea of the eternity of the Halachos of Torah. The Torah says that you can't eat the chazir, and then we say that in the future it will be mutter. The Torah's laws are here to stay. Says the Rama Mipano, the meaning behind the Medrash is not that the pig as we have it will be mutter. I mean, the Torah says it's osur. But why is it osur? Because although it has split hooves, but it doesn't chew the cud. What will change in the future, and that's actually the milder matter to change, is that the nature of the pig will change, so that it will become male geira. I mean, that's relatively easier to organize, so to speak. And therefore, once that's true, so then it will actually become a kosher animal, which leads us back to the question of the relationship between the simanim and the kashrus of the animal, but although there, it will identify it as a fundamentally kosher animal. And this is also the approach taken by the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, and he explains, even within the Pasuk, if we have a look again in Pasuk Zion, Vesachazir, ki mafris parsohu, it has split hooves. Vishasashesa parsohu, vuhu geirola yugar, but it doesn't chew the cud. So what's interesting about this Pasuk is that it mentions the kosher siman in the present. It is mafris parsa, but it mentions the non-kosher siman of not chewing the cud in the future, ru gera la yugar. But that's already inconsistent, it should say. In the same way that it says mafris parsa, it says ru gera einenu gar. So what does it mean by putting it in the future? It puts it in the future as if to say that as long as it will be this way, it is forbidden. Kol od, right, that it will continue not to chew the cud, it will be osur. But should that change, then it will be mutter. And it's interesting, just to kind of bring things together a little bit, we saw from the Ramban that in a sense, there's something, there's characteristics and qualities about the animals themselves that make them spiritually undesirable to be consumed. But the nature of the world in the future, the Ramban talks about this in Parshas Bichukosa, where he says, for example, that in reference to the pasuk of Vehishbati Chayara Min Haaretz, that wild animals will cease, and according to Rabbi Shimon in the Sifrei, that means that the nature of the beast will change. That's the pasuk in Yeshaya, Vegarza Evim Keves. And why? So the Ramban says, because originally everything was peaceful. With the sin of Adam HaRishon, etc., evil came into the world. It found its mark with certain species of animals, with the perfection of the world, so then also the nature of those animals will change. It could be that if the nature of those animals changes, if one may suggest some type of conceptual way of understanding how their status would change, it's because their state changes. I mean, their very essence will change. But be that as it may, nizke venire, we should be zocher to find out exactly what the pshat of the medrash is. Firstly, whoever needs to finish giving us back what they need to give us back, that should happen, and then the mitzvah Hashem, the rest of the medrash will take care of itself. We should be zocher to see it b'meir b'yamin.